We're going to start this show off with a little quiz. Can you guess what the following people all have in common? Mahatma Gandhi, Jay-Z, Winston Churchill, and Samuel L. Jackson. No, it's not a birthday. I admit, it's a tough one. It's kind of an odd list. Here's a hint from Samuel L.
As long as I've dreamt and imagined and practiced this speech, I ought to be a piece of cake, but it's not.
The answer is, they've all experienced FOPS, also known as fear of public speaking. Another name you can add to the list is someone who's always on the top of lists, but not because he's apprehensive about speaking to a group of people. It's Warren Buffett. Here's what he said on an HBO documentary.
I had been terrified of public speaking. Couldn't do it, I'd throw up. And I knew if I didn't cure it then, I'd never cure it.
So he did something about it and enrolled in a public speaking class.
If I hadn't have done that, my whole life would have been different.
According to the National Institute of Mental Health, fear of public speaking is the most common phobia, ahead of death, spiders, and heights. Think about that. People say they're more afraid of speaking in public than dying. That's not a good thing when you work at DIA, because at some point you'll be asked to brief senior leaders, perhaps at the Pentagon or even at the White House.
There is an art of keeping someone focused on what you're saying.
That's Kevin Lassiter. He teaches public speaking skills at DIA in a group called, well, let's let him tell you what it's called.
DIA loggers. Dialoggers. Get it? Dialoggers.
A speech that flows with perfect pacing and eloquence can be a work of art. And when it's delivered on the world stage, it can be a masterpiece. And sometimes, you even get a historical masterpiece.
As long as this scar of a wall is permitted to stand, it is not the German question alone that remains open, but the question of freedom for all mankind.
In Berlin, on June 12, 1987, President Ronald Reagan stood at the wall that separated people who weren't free from people who were. He made a speech for the ages. The author of that speech is our guest.
We all understood that this speech was going to be a big speech. It never crossed anybody's mind that it would be a speech that would be remembered many years later. I'm Peter Robinson, and I was a speechwriter and special assistant to President Reagan from 1983 to 1988.
Peter Robinson didn't just have a front row seat to history. He wrote it.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
This is DIA Connections.
They would say, I would rather die or get a root canal or I would rather do anything else but do public speaking.
As I looked out a moment ago from the Reichstag, that embodiment of German unity, I noticed words crudely spray-painted upon the wall, perhaps by a young Berliner. Quote, this wall will fall, beliefs become reality.
So you'd hear him in your mind as you wrote, and then you'd go hear him delivered in person. And over and over and over again, he'd do something with the material that made it even better than you had hoped.
Thanks for joining us on DIA Connections. We're calling this one Glossophobia. Okay, it's been about 5 seconds. Did you have enough time to Google it, or did you already know it? Glossophobia is the scientific term for fear of public speaking. It comes from the Greek word glossa, which means tongue, and phobos, which is dread or fear. Ronald Reagan didn't have it. He was one cool customer. But every statistic that we found indicates that 75% of the population does have it. In a little bit, you'll hear more from Peter Robinson about Reagan's speaking skills and the amazing backstory of the Berlin Wall speech. But first, let's talk about the reason why that 75% number is an important one for us at DIA. Our last episode was called The Right Stuff. It was about the written form of the intelligence that goes to policymakers. This episode is about the oral presentation of that intel. It's not an easy thing to do. Standing in front of a room of high-level officials and briefing classified material can be stressful. That's why there's a club called Dialoggers.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to another wonderful meeting, Dialoggers Toastmasters number 1149. I'm so glad that you all are joining us.
You gotta love the name, Dialoggers. It's our chapter of Toastmasters. Toastmasters is an organization that's been teaching public speaking skills for more than 100 years.
With me today, we have...
Former Dialoggers president Kevin Lassiter was eager to talk about it. We sat him down for a one-on-one, although he probably would have preferred an audience.
Meeting has started. I will now turn this portion of our meeting over to Heather.
Thanks for joining us, Kevin. Can you start by explaining why DIA officers need to be comfortable with public speaking?
One of the main things you have to do as an intelligence officer is communicate. Your main job is to communicate to either policymaker so that they can make a good decision. They can't make a good decision if they don't understand you. And they don't have time to sit for 5 to 10 minutes to listen to you ramble.
You get up, you speak for a minute, you see the green card. You speak for a minute and a half, you see the yellow card. 2 minutes, you see the red. Your goal is to speak for at least a minute, and by all means, finish after two.
That means you have to be sharp, you have to deliver, and if they have specific questions, you can answer those and take time and answer those. But they need something clear, concise, and quick so that they will have the tools that they need to make a decision.
You know, people really struggle with this. Not everyone's a natural like you are. Let me throw some facts at you. Around 15 million people deal with glossophobia daily, and studies show that it hinders promotion to management by 15%. For some, just thinking about making a speech can bring on rapid heartbeat, an increased blood pressure, and a nasty case of the sweats. Comedian Jerry Seinfeld may have summed it up best.
I saw a thing, actually, a study that said speaking in front of a crowd is considered the number one fear of the average person. I found that amazing. Number two was death. Death is number two? This means to the average person, if you have to be at a funeral, you would rather be in the casket than doing the eulogy.
So Kevin, when you train briefers, what message do you try and get across to them?
When I work with briefers, I tell them, listen, we have trained ourselves to believe that public speaking only exists when we are standing in front of a pool of people speaking on an important topic. We don't realize every day that we do public speaking when we're talking to our spouse, our brothers, our sisters, our moms and dads, our children, our co-workers and our bosses. That is public speaking. The art of public speaking and the definition of public speaking is communicating with someone outside of yourself.
So what about the do's and the don'ts? Start with the don'ts.
Don't put on a show. Be your natural self. Present it in a way that will hold your audience, but also be prepared of the information, especially as an intelligence officer, because you're a subject matter expert, but then so are they. So are the people that are listening to you. If you are the type of person that is very nervous and you're fidgety, use that to your advantage. People don't know how to use their space. They think that public speaking is just standing there and looking straight. They don't know that they can use their arms, they can be expressive, they can go back around, they can walk up and down. They can use what I call the white space.
There's not much funny about what DIA officers brief, so comedy is pretty much off the table. But in general, what do you think about using humor in a presentation? Because if it doesn't land, it can be kind of awkward. What do you think?
One of the problems that people have in public speaking is that they don't know themselves. So there is an art of public speaking, right? You have to know yourself. If you're not a funny person, don't try to be funny. Let it be natural.
But what if you are funny and you know how to read a room? A well-timed joke can be the ultimate icebreaker. Here again is Peter Robinson, speechwriter for Ronald Reagan.
Reagan loved opening with humor.
Just to show you how youthful I am, I intend to campaign in all 13 states.
The moment the audience laughed, they'd be relaxed. He would feel relaxed. He'd feel he had them, and he would already have given them something. He would already have given them a moment of pleasure. Start that way, and the rest of the speech is likely to go well.
Oh, Gene, I reloaded the camera. Remember, keep on taking pictures of anything unusual Bonzo does, huh?
It helps when your boss has perfect comedic timing, and he can remember his lines even when getting hit with oatmeal thrown from a chimpanzee. Like in the 1951 classic movie Bedtime for Bonzo.
Bonzo!
Professor Boyd, Bonzo, that wasn't a nice thing to do.
Bonzo!
Don't scold him, he didn't mean it.
Well, that's beside the point. Aggressiveness like that could become an aberration.
Not only was Peter grateful for Reagan's sense of humor, but he also liked that Reagan insisted on crafting a compelling story.
If you go back and read or listen to a Reagan speech in the whole, you will hear an argument being made with evidence.
But great as our tax burden is, it has not kept pace with public spending.
Reagan always wanted an argument carefully constructed. I heard him say half a dozen times, well, specificity is the soul of persuasion. He would say that in the speech meetings. He wanted facts, he wanted figures, he wanted statistics, he wanted an argument, and he wanted it supported.
Back now with Kevin Lassiter, the former president of the DIA Dialoguers chapter of Toastmasters. My last question for you is kind of selfish. My job would be a lot easier if you could find a way to get all of our interviewees to lose the dreaded ums and the uhs and the you knows. It would save a lot of time when I'm editing the podcast because I spend half my time trying to take all of those ums out. Any suggestions on how we could all be a little better with that?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So if you're presenting, write down notes and then add in your script pause. You are drawing your thoughts in, you're staying on track, and you're speaking. That's the great way to get rid of filler words. If you're not a natural pauser, write that in the script and understand yourself. And don't be afraid. A lot of people think when you're public speaking, you're supposed to be going. You're supposed to know what to say automatically. You are a human being. Your mind is processing. You're not going to know what to say every second. Don't be afraid to take a pause.
Peter. Pausing with purpose. Reagan was a master at that, and he did it with one well-placed word.
Well, that word.
Yep, that's the one.
Well.
That was a way of keeping a piece conversational.
Oh, it was more than just conversational. Well became a very effective device. And popular, too. Even Homer Simpson liked it.
Don't worry. I brought my Rappin' Ronnie Reagan tape. It always makes the trip go faster.
Well.
You know something? He did say well a lot.
Well. Peter Robinson never wrote any raps for the president who was known as the great communicator. But he did write over 300 speeches for him. That's quite an accomplishment, considering his career began with an epic self-awareness moment. He was studying at Oxford, writing what he thought would be a brilliant first novel.
I reread the material I had produced so far, and it was just terrible. So in a panic, I wrote letters to all kinds of people back home in the United States who might have leads on jobs, and almost nobody wrote back.
Eventually, one did. A friend told him about an opening on the speechwriting team for Vice President George Bush. And luckily, they didn't ask about his experience.
Nobody asked to see a writing sample. Nobody even asked whether I had ever written a speech before, and that was a very good thing for me because I never had.
But there was one more hurdle, if you can call it that. He still needed VP approval.
Welcome, sir. How are you?
The day came to introduce me to the Vice President.
Here we go.
And George Bush looked down at my shoes and then let his gaze trail slowly up to my face and said, well, he looks about the right height. Let's hope it works out. And that was how I got hired into the Reagan White House.
That's truly one of the most amazing right place at the right time stories I've ever heard. And you never wrote a speech before?
Never. Not one. Never. Writing speeches, I'm going to have to tell you, is not a high art. It's more of a knack. Either you can do it or you can't. But by a miracle, it turned out that I could.
You're 25, never wrote a speech, and you're thrown into the fire, so to speak. How did you get yourself up to speed?
I suppose one of the first things I had to do was learn the job of a speechwriter. So my first speech meeting with the vice president, it was him and me alone. And he leaned back in his chair, put his feet up on his desk, and his hands behind his head. I said, "Mr. Vice President, what would you like to say to the National Association of Manufacturers?" And he looked at me, hands behind his head, and said, "I don't know. What do you think I should say?" And I was flabbergasted. The idea that I should walk in with recommendations had not crossed my mind. But what he was doing in his gentle, humorous way was letting me know, "Young man, I'm busy. You're the speechwriter. Your job is not just to write. Your job is to know everything there is to know about the audience, what they'll be interested in hearing." It kind of shocked me, to be perfectly honest, because again, I keep saying this, that I was 25 years old and had no experience. But the speechwriter's job was actually quite a big job.
After 14 months with the vice president, Peter Robinson joined Reagan's team. He authored everything from State of the Union addresses to campaign fundraisers. But the speech in West Berlin at Brandenburg Gate, the iconic symbol separating democracy and communism, brought the most notoriety.
On August the 13th, 1961, East Germany put an end to the flights of refugees to the West by building a wall to keep people in and freedom out.
We all understood that this speech was going to be a big speech. It never crossed anybody's mind that it would be a speech that would be remembered many years later.
It would make for a good story if we told you that of the six speechwriters on Reagan's staff, Robinson was asked to write the speech because he was the best. But an even better story is the real one. As luck would have it, it was just his turn to write the next speech. So timing really is everything. Peter, 2 months prior to Reagan's speech, you went with the White House advance team to the Berlin Wall.
That's right.
What did you experience on that visit?
Very hard to convey what that felt like. Inside West Berlin, you felt as though you were in a normal city. Traffic, people dressed in bright colors, neon signs, motion and sound and color. And then you look over the wall into East Berlin. There's no color. You see soldiers near the wall. Very little sound. Could feel the weight of oppression. You actually felt something heavy on you as you looked down there and saw soldiers with binoculars and guns and barbed wire and so forth.
And that was something you thought should be reflected in the speech?
Right.
Talk about the process of striking the right tone. You had a meeting with a diplomat about that. What happened at that meeting?
He was the ranking American diplomat in Berlin. When I went to his office, I had a notebook and I asked for material. I started asking questions, and he gave me a list of things the president shouldn't say. Don't have Reagan sound like a commie basher. Don't have him sound like an anti-communist cowboy, and don't have him make a big deal about the wall. They've gotten used to it now. How is that possible? It made no sense to me that anybody could get used to that. I had seen the wall. I didn't know whether the diplomat said was right or wrong, but I knew I needed material for the president of the United States that would in one way or another equal the setting. And I had nothing.
Thank you. With the speech only a few weeks away, and Robinson desperate for information, he asked a friend in Washington to arrange a dinner at the home of someone he knew in Berlin.
Dieter and Ingeborg Eltz was their name. I was the only American there. It was maybe 18 people or so from different walks of life, physician, professor, homemakers, a couple of students. We're chatting about this, that, and the other, German weather and so forth. And then I just said, I visited the wall, and I had a meeting with the ranking American diplomat who told me that you've all gotten used to it by now. There was a silence that seemed to last a good long time. They just stopped talking. And then there's a moment when the silence, they look at each other, and one man speaks. He raises his arm, and he points off in one direction, and he says, my sister lives just a few kilometers over there, but I haven't seen her in more than 20 years. How do you think we could get used to that wall? And then it started. They went around the room. Each of them told a story about the wall. And then the hostess, lovely woman, she became quite angry. And she said, if this man Gorbachev is serious with us, talk glasnost and perestroika, he can prove it. He can come here and get rid of that wall. And that went right into my notebook. I just thought, the moment she said that, I thought, that's it. If Ronald Reagan were here, that's the remark he would respond to. It's simple, conveys a sense of human decency. It's compelling. So the line came from, or was suggested in effect, by a German Hausfrau.
He found the central theme for the speech at a dinner party in Berlin. But next, he needed approval in Washington for the four words that would be the most unforgettable of Reagan's presidency.
It was an iron rule in the Reagan White House that speeches went out to staffing before they went to the president. And this time, the speechwriters broke that rule. We got a copy of this to him on a Friday, and the following Monday, we had a meeting with him in the Oval Office. Now, there were a lot of speeches to be discussed, and we got to my speech was last. And Mr. President, what do you think of Peter's speech for Berlin? And Ronald Reagan just said, well, that was a fine draft. Good work. And that was it. And so I said, Mr. President, I learned in Berlin that the speech will be picked up by radio in the East so that you'll be listened to on both sides of the wall. And if the weather conditions are just right, they may be able to pick up the speech as far east as Moscow. Is there anything in particular you want to say to people on the other side, the communist side of the wall? And the president thought for a moment, and then he said, well, there's that passage about tearing down the wall. That's what I want to say to them. That wall has to come down.
Success. End of the story, right? The president likes it. Good. Done. Start printing. But it's Washington. It's not going to happen like that. The State Department and the National Security Council need to be on board too. And they weren't.
The draft went out to staffing. And for roughly 3 weeks, as I recall, from that moment that it went out to staffing to the day the president delivered it. And for all 3 weeks, the State Department and the National Security Council tried to suppress the speech. And one way they did this was by submitting alternative drafts on different pretexts. But the main point was that each of their drafts omitted the call to tear down the wall.
There was no objection to the destruction of the wall. Everyone wanted to see that happen. But the sentiment was, saying tear down the wall would antagonize Gorbachev, who was scheduled to visit Berlin 2 weeks later. One person I'm sure you're familiar with was definitely opposed to it. Peter, the deputy national security advisor at the time was General Colin Powell, and you had a somewhat spirited discussion with him about the line. Mainly, he wanted it out, and you didn't. How'd that meeting go?
Colin Powell got pretty rough with me. He was not used to insubordination from young men. And of course, as a very senior Army officer. He thought that he ought to be able to command a certain respect, and he had an idea about the way you treated young men who didn't provide the respect that he considered his due, and he just shouted at me. He let me have it. And you know what I did? I shouted right back at him. I just shouted right back at him. And he was so startled. I don't know which of us was more startled than the other. The point of all this is that when the president said he especially wanted to deliver that line, those who objected to the line, which is the State Department, National Security Council, and Colin Powell, really had only two options. One was to go to the president himself and say, you're mistaken. And lo and behold, they were reticent to do that.
Yeah, I can see why. What was option number two?
The other option was to go to me, because if I had written a memorandum saying, dear Mr. President, on mature reflection, I think that one passage I wrote may be out of order, let me substitute this material, the president would probably have deferred to the speechwriter who had gone and done original reporting on the scene in Berlin. And that's why Colin Powell hollered at me, I hollered back, and he just stood up and walked out. There wasn't much he could do to me. He couldn't send me to the brig. I wasn't some sort of junior officer whom he could discipline. So if I stood my ground, they really had no place to go, and I did.
The ink wasn't dry yet. There was still one more tweak to be made.
The audience in front of him would be German, but the audience watching at home on television would be American. And it occurred to me, maybe we want a big applause line from the Germans listening to him. So I put the central line in one draft, I put it in German. Herr Gorbachev, machen Sie dieser Tor auf. And my boss, Tony Dolan, read that and just said, Peter, when your client is the president of the United States, give him his big lines in English.
Earlier in the show, I said that Peter Robinson had a front row seat to history. I meant it metaphorically.
Thank you.
Ironically, he wasn't even with the 40,000 gathered at Brandenburg Gate on that momentous day.
Thank you very much. Chancellor Kohl, Governing Mayor.
When the time came for Reagan to read Robinson's words, he was already back in the States.
I was too junior to join the traveling party, and I ended up watching the speech from my bachelor pad in Arlington, Virginia. And up to that very moment, I had no idea whether the president would deliver the draft as I wrote it, or whether by then State and the NSC would have succeeded in suppressing it and replacing the draft that I wrote with a draft of their own. So I turn on my little Sony Trinitron and listen to him deliver the speech.
24 years ago, President John F. Kennedy visited Berlin.
Little tiny screen, so I'm sitting close to it so I can see him. He starts with the introduction, which I'd written. I recognized every word, and then I get more and more and more tense.
We welcome change and openness, for we believe that freedom and security go together. The advance of human liberty can only strengthen the cause of world peace.
There is one sign the Soviets can make that would be unmistakable. And now I can barely breathe, because he's right there with the buildup.
General Secretary Gorbachev, if you seek peace, if you seek prosperity for the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, if you seek liberalization, come here to this gate.
Mr. Gorbachev, open this gate.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
And I can barely remember the rest of the speech because I felt such relief. I remember just sitting on the floor feeling so relieved. Now, this is what a worm I was. Did I think, what a blow for freedom. What a good speech for him to deliver for the sake of the West Berlin people. No, all I thought was, those bastards at State, we beat them.
And almost 2.5 years later, it was over.
I'm Peter Jennings in New York just a short while ago. Astonishing news from East Germany, where the East German authorities have said, in essence, that the Berlin Wall doesn't mean anything anymore. The wall.
This has been a city physically divided for 28 years, but now it's come together, East and West, in a spontaneous outburst of emotion.
I asked Peter about his place in history and about the speech linking him to the president and, in a larger sense, to freedom. He wanted no part of that.
I was a speechwriter. Reagan is connected to freedom. I was just trying to hit my deadlines. I'm totally serious about that. I was just trying to do the best job I could for him. It was Reagan taking material and elevating it, infusing it with meaning that even I as a writer hadn't seen in it.
He wanted us to know one more thing. He told us what the president did earlier on the day of the speech and how it lifted the words off the page.
There was a moment when he was taken to the same observation platform I had looked over, and he looked over the wall, and his West German guide explained that East Berliners had begun to gather earlier that morning to hear Reagan's speech, but that an hour or two earlier, East German police had dispersed the crowd. And Reagan said that as he got to that passage, he thought of those people being dispersed by the police. And when he delivered that line, "Tear down this wall," he was really angry. And you can feel it and you can hear it. "Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. It was just beautiful. It was just beautiful.
Glossophobia, the fear of public speaking. Hopefully, you learned about a few ways to overcome it and why it's important to us at DIA and in the intelligence community. And who knows, if you can get over your glossophobia, maybe someday you'll change history. As always, thanks for listening to DIA Connections.